The views expressed by the hosts or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and our clients do not necessarily reflect those of the hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform should be read or construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carries varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial advice, legal advice, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Unfiltered opinion.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
Because you secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
I'm Jimmy Moyaha.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
It is Halloween.
Yeah.
It's coming up.
Because it's my birthday.
Oh!
Not yet. 2 days.
Okay. Yeah. Horror investing stories. I think that's appropriate. What's one that comes to the top of your mind?
I mean, there's so many. It's got to be one that I was involved in personally. because, you know, otherwise there's just too many. I mean, so I don't have a lot of them because I was always just too scared of the market, I suppose. But I do have them. So my horror investing story, Brainware, Piet den Boer. IPOs in about 96 at R1 a share. I drop 20K in. It goes up to 6 or 7 rand. My 20K is now worth 120,000, 140,000. The whole .com collapses. It goes down to be worthless. They do a 50-for-1 consolidation. I got my money back in 2012. So what's that? 18 years later, my 20,000, I got a 52 rand check.
Wow. Okay. I don't know if mine's going to top that or even come close to that. I was fortunate enough, or rather unfortunate enough, depending on which side of the table you're sitting on, to be looking at Steinhoff collapse.
Oh.
I come into work, I sit down at my PC, and get a phone call from a client. Client says, we've just wired X amount of money through our bank account. Please make sure the funds are allocated to the account before market open. Now, sizable amount of money. Money gets onto the client's account. Happy days. Steinhoff opens 30% lower.
I remember that.
Market goes into auction. So I think that Steinhoff was trading at about 80 rand a share at that point.
70, 80
opened at 59, 60 rand. Opening price. Market immediately goes into auction. I sit there. I see the market move. And I'm like, this is not going to be a good day. I don't. At this point, I hadn't had the amount of experience I have now. And even then, I knew that the JSE auction takes place if a share price moves by X percent.
Volatility auction.
Yeah, volatility auction. I'm like, okay, cool. Phone the client. Hey, Mr. Client, this is what's happening. We're in a volatility auction right now. When we come out of volatility auction, do I have instructions from you? Client says, no, everything's fine. We've just wired you more money. Make sure it gets on the account. I'm like, that's fine. That's okay. So, now I'm twitching on the inside because I'm looking at this balance and that's not a good thing. Comes out of volatility auction, 60 Rand down to 40 Rand. Phone back the client, sir, we're in another volatility auction. We're at 40 Rand. This is not looking the way it should. Nope, we hold. We're fine. We're great. Cool. Now in my head, share price drops within 2 or 3 hours by 50%. There's something wrong.
Yeah.
Then the media reports come out. Steinhoff, accounting irregularities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Long story short, 4.5 million rand in about 3 hours on the Steinhoff thing. Just disappeared and wiped out.
Okay.
And yeah, that was a first-hand account, first-hand experience watching it happen. And wow. But yeah, let's
horror stories.
Horror stories as part of Halloween. Let's kick the show off. Starting off with Market Matters, we're going to be taking a look at the BRICS currency and the fact that the South African Airways is debt-free. Yes, I said it. I'll say it slower. Debt-free. I'm just as shocked, and I spoke to the chairman about that, actually. Let's start with that, actually. I caught up with Derek Hanekom, chairman of SAA, about the fact that they're debt-free. And I was like, what do you mean debt-free? So Derek Hanekom, for context, has been in parliament or in various ministerial positions for 28 years since the, I think since the Mandela administration or the Mbeki administration. And I asked him, quite frankly, I said, in your 28 years, have you seen this? Because I haven't been alive much longer, but this is the first time I'm seeing it, you know? And we joke about it, but the reality is for an SOE to be debt-free in 2024...
Imagine if Eskom was debt-free.
Imagine that, right? So, yeah, for me, that was my big market thing this week, was seeing that SAA is debt-free, and a very clear statement from the current board that they will not be going for bailouts. They are, and bailouts is important because midterm budget policy statement is taking place on the 30th. It's going to be something where we're going to see what's going to happen on that side. But one less thing of the many things we have to worry about, one thing we don't have to worry about is SAA borrowing money.
Yeah. Look, they need a capital raise, but they can do that right now because they are debt free. They can raise that in equity markets, debt markets. They can go to, I mean, they've got options now. Debt free. It actually means my Voyager miles are definitely safe.
And you know what I like about the prospect of SAA? It's the national carrier. It has the backing of the state, directly or indirectly. That's why the privatization deal with Takatso kind of went the way it went. But at the same time, it's an opportunity set, right? I look at SAA and I think for a 3 billion rand investment to now be getting access to a national carrier that is probably easily something you can turn into the largest on the continent very quickly if you do it right. A 3 billion rand investment into that is not a bad idea, hey?
Yeah, although Ethiopia Air will have words with you, but yes.
Yeah, but think about Ethiopia Air. They went through all of that change to actually build Ethiopia Air to that point. It took them a lot of discipline, and they got it right? Imagine if we had that level of discipline with the experience that we have for SAA, because at one stage, SAA was the largest on the continent.
Yeah.
And we are an international carrier. We have got the capacity in terms of airport to fly to Brazil, to do the long-haul flights. You can, in the aviation world... And I have no aviation experience, but this is a mouth-watering deal at 3 billion rand investment, debt-free to start on a base as high as what the base is.
Yes, you're not launching Simon and Jimmy's airline.
Yes, right? Yeah. And we could do that. You know, don't knock us. We don't know if we're capable of running an airline or not. But that's the thing. You're not coming from a point where...
You're not using my 3 billion to find out if you are.
But that's the thing. You're not coming from a point where nobody knows the brand. Nobody knows the name. Yeah. Nobody knows the reputation.
Yeah.
It's just been about mismanagement. And you're launching off of a very good base. And for me, that's even a better base than the BRICS currency, which we now have.
Yay! We have a BRICS currency.
We have a BRICS currency. What's it's not replacing the old currencies. So that's the important starting point, is we're not suddenly all going to be trading in BRICS dollars or BRICS whatevers. I'm not quite sure what we're calling it just yet. But it is going to run parallel alongside existing domestic currencies. And this is going to be mainly for the purposes of trade, which I think is the best way you could have launched this, right? To find a uniform currency that doesn't devalue all of the existing currencies. It doesn't seek to replace them. In time, it might. But you launch it on its own. You peg it against the gold price, or you peg it against gold bars, in which case you're decoupling from the dollar as well. But you've effectively established a new uniform kind of trade system.
Sure. The gold bars part is complex because who's gold bars? I mean, like, where do the gold bars come from? I take your point for payments. And I think we're seeing a lot of it post the Russia invasion of Ukraine, where suddenly you don't want to go through dollars because you're selling sanctioned oil. So you want to do trade in rubles or something like that. And that kind of works. But I've had conversations on my show before. Is it like, is the infrastructure, is the trust there, et cetera, et cetera? You need that sort of middle currency which you trade through. You know, if I'm shipping something to Ghana, and they're not part of BRICS. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm worried that I'm going to drop it in and you know, will I see my money? Will I see my product? You sort of go through the BRICS currency almost as a clearinghouse to have that trust, again, almost like a USDT or something, a crypto, a blockchain.
Mm.
So in that sense, yes. In terms of it becoming, you know, I just did a quick Google, and the first one is BRICS banknote unveiled end of the dollar. No, not end of anything just yet, but sure. Just a clearing currency, so we can all avoid, because, and we've said this before in this show and other places, you know, Bretton Woods was the sort of what gave the dollar its status. Mm-hmm. And how beautiful that your currency, people are trading it, not because they care about you, but because two people in a different continent want to buy and sell maize, and suddenly they want to buy dollars first because that's the currency of the world.
But think about what this could fundamentally mean when we talk de-dollarization. And I've had economists like Davy Ruert say de-dollarization will never happen in our lifetime and all of that. And it might not happen in our lifetime. But think about what you have fundamentally put forward in a different clearing currency. Because that's what the dollar was, a clearing currency, right? Every transaction would go through dollars, and the conversion into the dollar and into something else would be where the US banks would, as intermediary banks, make some money. The benchmark then becomes the dollar, right?
Yeah.
But now you're dealing with so much of the population, of the world, the global population, that is, right? So you're dealing with, I think it's 30% of the global population, or 50% of the global population and 30% of the global GDP, if I've got those figures the right way around. That is not a small amount, right? Now, if that amount of people can sort of come to a uniform agreement of saying that we can clear in dollars or we can clear in the BRICS currency, then that poses a very fundamental change in how we look at fiat currencies and how we look at the landscape of trade around the world, because it means that 30% of the GDP of the world can be transacted outside of dollars. That's never happened in history.
And it's just going to,
And that 30% is the starting point, which means it's not going to get less than 30%.
Exactly. And there's the queue of people coming up who's saying, we're keen, we want to get involved. And No, I agree. And I think it is, I think it's noteworthy. I don't think it's the death of the dollar in any hurry. The dollar is gently fading. That'll happen over time. But as Davy says, not in our lifetimes, not in you youngsters' lifetimes either. But it is just a different clearing currency, which is kind of what the euro does, right? So in the olden days, you know, if I don't know, if Germany and Italy wanted to transact, yes, they could use the Deutschmark and the lira, whatever it was in Italy, with all the zeros, and it was perfectly. But now it's just euro. It just makes it so much simpler and so much easier. Mm. I mean, I've often thought I would quite like almost like a SADC currency or sub-Saharan Africa. Muhammad Gaddafi wanted to do that. I mean, he was a big proponent of an African currency.
And he wanted that to be backed by gold reserves, which now we've got a BRICS currency. It's not far, now it's even better than what Muhammad Gaddafi envisioned, because you're not limited to one continent. You're limited to anyone that is a partner in that space. So think about the United Nations, think about the Eurozone, think about any organization where multiple countries from around the world come together, suddenly have an agreement to say that this is the benchmark and this is the new establishment of how that benchmark is to be measured. Yes, it's going to take a while for adoption to kick in and all of that, but if you start to say, when I transact with European countries, I transact in euros. When I transact with BRICS currencies, I transact in BRICS. That's a fundamental change in, I can now trade with India in BRICS, and it does not have to go via Europe or the US or anyone else.
So then two thoughts.
Hmm.
If we back it by gold, firstly, be long gold. and secondly, then it becomes the only serious currency, apart from the ZIM, that's backed by gold.
Well,
because, I mean, are there any other non-fiat currencies out there?
Technically not, but okay, so backing aside, right, and let's play devil's advocate on the backing side of it. What is the American dollar backed by? Sentiment.
sentiment.
Okay, so if we can we not back this one by sentiment?
No, sure. No, we absolutely can. we absolutely can. In which case, maybe less non-gold.
Yeah, less long gold, but still, yeah. Either way. That's what's happening in the world, and that's Market Matters for this week. In our deep dive this week, we take a look at portfolio management and understanding the different types of portfolio management that exist out there. And we're joined in studio by a good friend of ours, an esteemed guest, who also happens to be the CEO of a leading brokerage in South Africa, the CEO of Scope Markets, Rob van Aden, joins us to take a look at the world of portfolio management from his perspective, and that is 30 years of financial services experience. Rob, thanks so much.
Good morning, Jimmy.
30 years is a long time, eh?
I was just thinking 30, but...
Yeah, 30 years.
Are you 30, Jimmy?
I am.
Just checking.
Just about, but I am.
I think the irony is, 30 years, and then over the weekend, we celebrated our 40 years since being out of school. So it goes quickly. I think it goes quickly. And time flies, and you know how things have changed. You know, when I matriculated, South Africa looked very different. When I started in this industry, the industry also looked very different, but very similar in a lot of ways in terms of, you know, people still wanting to enter the market, people still doing the same silly things they did 30 years ago. I think it's a lot easier. And, it's a lot easier than 30 years ago. But the challenge remains, you know, we are driven by the same things as 30 years, and that's why people get into the market. I always call it the three horsemen of markets, which is fear, greed, and hope. You can add a new one, maybe FOMO. So nothing's changed, but thank you for the invitation and looking forward to the chat this morning.
Rob, you've written a couple of books.
Yes.
Why? So I don't mean it in a malicious way, but I mean, there we go. See, right? And the books, if anyone has read the books, or anyone hasn't read Rob's books, they're very practical, very logical, very straightforward, right? Why did you feel that was the easiest way to convey the message?
It's an interesting one. I think as you go through your journey of life, there becomes an innate need to pay it forward, to share knowledge. Now, Simon's been doing it for many years. You're starting to do it for many years. It is basically to share our excitement and our learnings of the financial markets. The one thing I can tell you about writing a book, you don't earn a lot of money.
And it's hard work.
It's extremely hard work. And the worst is you get criticized quite a lot. You start by, you get an editor that basically from day one, with the right intentions, would criticize you for your writing, the way you write and things like that. So you have to be quite persistent and quite resilient. And then when you get to a publisher, which I got through this one, the process happens again. You get their editor, they bash you again. It feels like round number 14 in a good Rocky movie, giving away my age. But it's 14 rounds, but eventually you get through it. And then just before the final bell ring, they bring in a person called a copywriter, which I never knew what they do, but they're even worse than the editors. So to your question, it's me paying it forward and also through the experience that I've built up, basically sharing my knowledge. And the books I've written are in two categories. The first two books is more on investing, buy and keep. And I'm a big proponent. The first book was The Money Fountain, where I proposed the idea for most people. It's probably the best idea, buy an ETF that tracks an indice like the S&P 500 or the All Share, forgive me, the top 40, buy and forget. And you'll do well. On average, earn like 10 or 13% a year. Forget it. It's not cool. I know it's not cool because when you're going at the buys and you're saying, it's much more exciting to say I'm a trader and I trade and I buy. It's not as cool to say I own an ETF, you know, or Satrix ETF or whatever ETF.
And it's up 8% this year.
8%, yeah,
It's more exciting to say I made 30% on non-farms numbers or something else that's come
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, over time, just to accommodate the people that do want excitement in their life, I started formulating an idea of a satellite portfolio and a core portfolio, where I still propose the core portfolio should be 80% ETFs. And if you want a bit of excitement in your life, you go away and trade for the 20% and you can see if you can succeed or not. And this was basically my last book called The Badass Trader. People that know me are quite surprised by the title. The title was supposed to be The Unbeatable Trader, but you know, at the end of the day, they want to market books. And I changed the word to Badass Trader. I took a fat chance with the publishers, and they liked it. And the book was launched last year. It's sold about 3,000 copies in South Africa, which I'm quite pleased about. Yeah, and this book is not about, you know, I don't give away the secret sauce about how to trade, because there is no secret sauce. A topic I want to come on maybe on some other shows is why AI is not the secret sauce. It's a good servant but a bad master. So the Badass Trader is basically to look at the process of becoming a successful trader. And then it's balanced. All three books are balanced by behavioral finance. I spent a lot of time in looking at the biases. I've just mentioned them: fear, hope, greed. There are a lot of stuff. It started with Kahneman and Tversky when they came out and won the Bell Prize. And this book, I spent a lot of time on these biases. And the book actually started, I started naively on a weekly basis pushing out those principles on LinkedIn. Which have become more of, you know, I think principles, and some of them are applicable to life, some are applicable in trading. I clocked number 270 on Saturday, and that's how the book started. It was basically a publisher approached me and said, gosh, back then I wrote about 105 of these things, and if I go back to the first two or three, how embarrassing, how embarrassing. And I think it was just myself and my wife that liked them as well.
So, not even your kids.
No, my kids. I had to go you know, force him to basically like it. And that's evolved. You know, again, so at the moment I've got about 25,000 followers. I've been pushing these principles, and I will keep on pushing these principles, because for me it's about paying forward. It's for me to look, as I mentioned in the book as well, trading is the hardest, easiest things. But once you sort out a couple of things, it's probably the easiest thing to do. But those couple of things are the hardest. And that's why if you look at, you know, CFD providers based in the UK, the FCA requires them to say how many clients lose money. And it's between 70 to 80%. And that's on a three-month average. It's a lot higher. You know, I've worked for one of them as well in the past. It's a lot, lot higher. So that's why coming back, I want to pay it forward. I want people to remember the core and the satellite. Stick with ETFs. But if you want something racing and daring, trade away.
Yeah, I'm looking at a local CFD broker. 69% of retail clients
lose their funds. Look, the trading game is not for everyone. This is the thing we've said from the beginning. You're trading highly leveraged, highly risky products. And if you don't understand what you're doing, you should get financial advice around that. You should get some professional help. And that's kind of why we're having this particular deep dive, is there's different ways to approach the trading journey, and there's different ways to approach the portfolio management journey as well. And I think what's interesting is, for the longest time, whether you're on the retail side of it or, in our case, the institutional side of it, you kind of have the same things that you bring to the table. I mean, I think about how the retail landscape is shifting away from what we traditionally know to now more prop firms, and you buy an account and you trade an account. But that's been around in the stockbroking world for years. That's been the norm. It's not a new thing. And certainly there are different styles to approaching something like a portfolio management, where you have the core portfolio, you have the exciting side of it. But if this is your day-to-day, if you want to make this your career and your bread and butter, you best understand how to manage a portfolio.
Yeah. No, and piecing it together, and it comes to your point, and it's what I've always done, that core part. And people are always amazed how much of my portfolio is a core portfolio, and importantly, sitting in boring ETFs. They're like, really? But we thought you were a trader. I'm like, yeah, that's the pointy bit up top.
80% boring, 20% fun. 90% boring, 10% fun.
Yeah, the Pareto principle, it's applicable to investing and trading as well. That 20-80 rule is applicable to so many things.
Rob, when we think about the portfolio management landscape, right? And I want to kind of, because both you and Si have been in the banking world where you've kind of seen that stockbroking environment, the trading house environment. You come in, you buy a seat, and your seat gets you access to a trading floor, gets you access to some research. Maybe if you're really lucky, gets you access to a Bloomberg terminal, and it's see for yourself from there, right? That kind of trading setup is something we're seeing the retail market start to replicate, where people start to get together, trade in groups, trade a certain set of news together, and all of that. It's all good and well to approach that, but the actual requirement of trading, like the skill set that's required in trading and the discipline that's required in trading, you speak of it a couple of times in your principles that you put out. I keep an eye on those principles and I see every one of them that comes up. But it's always something that's been touched on, that when you are in that environment, that is where the most discipline is required. That's where portfolio management is required and not just a trader title.
Yeah, it's quite interesting how things have changed but stayed the same, because, you know, when I started in the market, stockbroking firms were divided into three categories. The first category was firms supporting retail traders. So, for example, the banks in terms of do-it-yourself, and the bank supported with education. You know, Simon at Standard Bank, and we provided research, and, you know, Standard Bank is still doing a really good job in providing education and research. This could be a topic for another day. I don't think the regulator in terms of the JSE is doing a superb job in terms of education. And I've been quite vocal about it as well. The second category would be institutional stockbrokers. So they make their money out of, you know, corporate access, research, and providing liquidity. And then there was a third group, and this is the interesting group, is basically where you could join a stockbroking firm as an individual. You would be trading with a group of fellow-minded traders. And it was usually in a house or in a beautiful setting. Yeah,
fancy offices something. It was always nice setups.
Yeah, like New York loft style. And it was probably a precursor to how a lot of the fintech offices look. So they were like pool tables and relaxed, dressed. While, you know, where we came from, Simon and myself, we had to dress up every day, collar and tie. Simon with lace with a tie.
Do you still own ties?
Yeah. I got a collection of ugliest ties you ever saw.
So, yeah.
It's another story for another day.
So, and then they were called prop houses, but they were, the requirement was that they had to be members of the JSE. So they were regulated stockbroking firms. A lot of people were attracted to these firms. They worked slightly different to what we're seeing now. I'll just focus on the past. If you wanted to join one of these prop houses, you had to pay a seat fee, which meant physically that you could go in every day and you would have a seat. And for that, you would have access to Bloomberg's or Reuters. There would be usually one or two of them. You would have also have access to other like-minded traders.
Yeah.
Because the big thing with these prop houses, you know, to succeed in trading, it requires two things. It basically requires a process, and at these shops, you would have probably picked up a process, and it needs coaching and mentoring. Mm. Because I find it very surprising that people can start trading. It's the same thing. My son can fly a 747 on Microsoft Simulator very well. I don't think anyone would trust him in terms of, if I had to go, let's say, the ones that are still flying at British Airways or Lufthansa and say, he's ready, can he do a flight? And this is the misnomer about trading, because everyone thinks it's quite easy. Mm. So the advantage of, you know, working in one of these prop firms, it's like-minded people, and they still exist, and they'll teach you some sort of edge, which is surprising, because I think most of us think these edges are very grand. They're not. They are, because remember, at the end of the day, it's price, and everything else is a derivative of price. And I'll just point in my view of AI, why AI won't work, because the economies we're working in and markets are open systems. AI can't predict in open, but that's another story for another day. So those are the advantages. So, and there are still a couple of them based in South Africa as well, predominantly in the Cape region, in Cape Town. So you go, you buy a seat, it costs you X amount. In the process, they would teach you some sort of method with an edge. But the other thing they teach you, which is critical to successful trading, is risk management.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, you could probably, I was listening to a podcast, also a great friend of ours, Garth McKenzie, last week, where he interviewed a market wizard, Tom Basso, and Garth actually fell on his back. Tom's success rate or win rate is 34%.
Mm.
But he is a multimillionaire, and he was actually one of the first market wizards in Jack Swagger's books. So this is also one of the things that confuses a lot of people. You need a high winning rate. You need good risk to reward or risk to return ratios, which they teach you at these shops.
Mm.
So if you succeed, the deal is you pay your 5,000 Rand, and then, for example, and then at the end of the month, there's a profit split. It's usually 70%, 70 to 80% to you, and then 20% to the company. So that's how it developed, and they are still going on. They're not as big as they used to be, because we've seen with online trading, you know, we've seen the likes of FMTO moving, where they also offer capital.
Mm-hmm.
That is quite important. Also reason why you join the shops. You've got access to capital, and they also usually have better pricing.
Mm-hmm.
In terms and access to liquidity. But the shift has moved across to the likes of FTMO, where you need to write some sort of qualification test. You probably do that on a demo account.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've passed that, then they will decide in terms of how much they allocate to you. The advantage is it's another way of funding for traders,
mm-hmm.
because the problem is there are costs involved. And you know, I always talk about $100,000, $100,000. It's probably what you need to start trading with, you know, to make it worth your while. That's my personal view. You know, even in trading, if you're not trading leverage in South Africa, anything less than 15,000 Rand per trade, you know, will just kill you in terms of the required yeah. percentage return. So we've seen that. So we've still got the traditional prop houses.
Mm.
And then we've seen this movement of funded prop trading, where it is a bit different. The difference is you need to pass a qualification test. You pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar to the old one where you pay 5,000 Rand a seat. The only difference is if you fail the qualification test, you do not get funded.
Mm. But you can always come back and sort of re-enter and re-buy in.
Yeah.
And I think that, for me, I understand why the qualification test is in place.
Yeah.
It's the risk management side of it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We put
yeah.
in place conditions. Can you manage risk yeah. under these conditions? And for me, that's what kind of sets apart different traders, portfolio managers, whatever we want to call them. And I think what I like about the prop model is that individuals can have access to higher capital, because in South Africa, that is quite a challenge. In most emerging market countries, it is quite a challenge to have to sit there and come up with $100,000, the 100,000 rands or whatever the 100,000 currency is to yeah. be able to start that. But yeah. if you can, for a small fee, access that capital, yes. that's a good thing. But what we're also seeing is that on the retail side of it, there are players from a service provider point of view, the broker, that are now taking advantage of this and yeah. saying, hang on, we now see that this is something that could benefit us, and they make those challenges unreasonably hard, or they make the conditions unfair towards you that's trying to actually access the capital.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. I think good intentions in the financial markets end up with something bad. You know, so the intention is to provide capital, and there's some very reputable companies globally. We've seen moves into South Africa. I think, why do people fail? So there might be an innate intention that they do fail because they run a subscription model and they address, you know, let's call it the hope,
yeah.
the bias of hope. You know, mm. there's hope. At least there's hope. If I can achieve this, I've got access to $100,000. If on average, which is a good average, I can make 20 to 30% return, that's a 20 to 30% income per year, that's pretty decent living. And again, let's be honest, if you can do trading, you love trading, it's probably the easiest thing, and it's probably mentally onerous, but you know, you don't have a boss over your head, you don't have to do KPIs, you don't have to do goal setting, nothing, your goal. So that is a challenge at the moment. So we're seeing a lot of these, let's call it scams, coming through where people pay good money to pass the test. And then there are reputable companies that do offer them, but then a lot of people that apply for these qualification tests to get funded don't know the basic principles of trading. The big one is they don't understand the risk to return ratio, you know, 2-to-1. They are very focused, like, you know, when people chat to us, the first thing they ask is, how accurate is your system?
What is the latency on price lag? How wide is your spread? And those sorts of things. And you say that, Rob, but the reality is if you've worked in the financial system and you actually have taken the time to understand the processes, it doesn't matter what the spread is. If you're pricing your market and you're pricing your position sizing and your risk management, you factor those things in already.
Absolutely. And it surprises me, you know, like some of these signal providers saying that they're 99% accurate. If you're 99% accurate, you do that for 6 or 7 years, you will be there with Musk in terms of...
It'll all be yours.
You'll be the man there as number one. You'll be the next trillionaire. He won't be. So I think a lot of people come in, it's an emotional decision. They come in, they don't understand the risk to return. And then there's another big one that they usually bring in is maximum drawdown, which is totally unheard of in the retail market, which is very well known in the hedge fund world, that your drawdown can't be more than 10% per month. They have never heard of this. So they think you can swing, you know, about, and then suddenly they get – so it's a knowledge thing. So the good operators out there spend a lot of time on education. But again, people think it's such an easy thing. So – why would I bother with education? You know, I'll just climb in, I'll watch my favorite YouTube video, and then follow some guy, and then, you know, pay my application fee or subscription fee or whatever you want to call it, and off I go. And then within 1 month, I pass the test and they let me loose to trade. That's not the case, because they need to risk manage as well. It's their capital. It's not your capital. So... again, you know, on a high level, I think it's a really good thing. Like all of these things, there are operators that do it for the wrong reasons. And there are operators that kind of do it for the right reasons, but don't help people to succeed. And both Simon and myself are huge advocates of education. Educate, demo trade, paper trade, whatever trade before, and make sure that you've got an edge before you do any of this stuff.
And it comes to the point, and it's why I like the sort of old school prop places, which still exist to a degree, because you're surrounded by traders, by people who've done it. You're the newbie there, and they're going to, you know, start you small and say, you know, help you with position size, help you with exits and entries and all of that sort of thing. Learning from the smart techs, because I remember in the late 90s when I was starting to trade, man, it was lonely out there.
It does get lonely out there. I mean, when we built Lotus Academy about 4 years ago, that was part of the reason as well. It was to pass on what we had known, what we had learned, and to show people that it wasn't really that hard, or it wasn't really as... clouded as people thought it might be, but it did require education. It did require discipline. Unfortunately, as these segments always go, we are out of time, but I would encourage everyone to get the book, Badass Trader, by Rob Van Aden. Anyone that doesn't know who that is, once you've read the book, you'll definitely know. This is just the first of many books Rob has written. This is the latest of the books. So you can actually read the books in reverse chronological order. So start at the latest, work your way backwards, figure it out. But there it is, the Badass Trader. And that is the deep dive for this week.
Mm-hmm.
And we wrap things up with Investor Insights. Rob Van Aden has been gracious enough to stick around for this, because this week in Investor Insights, we're taking a look at signal providers. We're taking a look at what you need to understand about regulation and regulated parties. We've spoken about these things. We keep hopping on around these particular topics, and people keep not wanting to listen until it's too late. I want to, and for me, it's such a pain point, because I do these weekly catch-ups with the FSCA themselves, and we go through these warnings. And I want to kick off with one that's been very personal to Rob, and that's why I've asked Rob to stick around for this one, is impersonations. We've seen brokers now. So initially it was just people. Hey, we are representing Elon Musk, and he's got this investment scheme or whatever, and great. But now we're seeing brokers are doing it. Now you're seeing, and brokers are denying doing it, saying, oh, it wasn't us. I know of a recent broker that's taken place in South Africa, and it's a big one, because this particular broker also happens to be the sponsor of South Africa's national football team. So you automatically know that broker's licensed, and that's supposed to provide an element of trust. But when you go onto this online deepfake scam that's been going through, and you've got a video in real time of Johan Rupert saying, I've launched this and this and this and this, and in launching this, I want to get you guys to invest in it. This is the amount you invest. And you click on the button, and it redirects you to a broker site where the broker can capture your information, and you fund your trading account with that particular broker. I find it very hard to believe that that party didn't know that this deepfake scam was taking place. And those impersonation scams are rife, whether in the local market or around the world, but particularly in South Africa. Rob, you were the victim of something similar?
Yeah, I was the victim of two. So there was a gentleman that was promised to put in 50,000 rand and he could get 60 million.
And what a return on investment.
What a return on investment. And apparently I was based in Kimberley. But he used my name, and he also used Scope Markets for who I work for, and basically saying the words were used, we are going through a temporary bankruptcy, which is very weird. Are you either bankrupt or you're not?
It's only until you give us your 50,000.
Yeah, so be quick and pay us across. So that was the one case. And then last week, one of my back office people presented an ID of me, which was also quite interesting. So first of all, it was my picture of on my LinkedIn, not a face picture, but a profile picture. And then I actually felt quite flattered initially, because I was about 10 years younger than my initial number. So that helped. Yes, it is happening. There was actually a notification last week on the FSCA website that even the commissioner of the FSCA was impersonated. It's happening with the people working at the receiver of revenue. It's happening even at the, there's no old bars. If the FSCA commissioner is getting impersonated, it's rife. Look, I think all of us, you know, both of you are media personalities. I think we try and manage it by applying, you know, getting the blue label or the blue ticks on our social platforms. But it's very difficult. Like I said, it was a picture of me. There are plenty of pictures of us on the website. It's easy to clip. But I do think, firstly, with this person that was promised 16 million, if it's too good to be true, it is.
Yeah.
Do your homework. Do your searches. You know, we do all have legitimate profiles on LinkedIn or Instagram or wherever. Contact us on these platforms and say, is this genuine you? And you know, I also make it very clear on LinkedIn that I do not sell anything, you know, because I'm not into that game. But it is rife, and I expect, you know, this is where AI will also not be, working in favor of the financial markets. There's a lot of things it can help us with. But in terms of these deep fake, you know, personalities, I think the next level, it will probably be holograms chatting to you that would look like us.
And it is, and they've got fancy. There was a time, and it's faded away, where once or twice a week there'll be someone impersonating me on Twitter. And they'll basically just copy my exact profile and off to the races.
I still send you those. I still send you TikTok profiles and
TikTok
everything.
Ones
and so here's my thing. The nerve of the impersonator to add me as a friend under Simon's banner, as if I don't know who Simon is, and I'm not going to send it to him and verify. Like, for me, that's what gets to me, right? Yeah. Is you are impersonating someone I know on a personal level, and I'm going to send it to them.
Yeah.
I've seen this happen with Rob. I've seen this happen with Simon. I don't think I'm popular enough for it to have happened with me. But if anyone out there sees a profile that has my photo, there are hundreds of photos of me, of Simon, of Rob online. If you see any of our profiles out there that says that we're going to offer this, this, and this, we are not those people. And I'll say this because we say it every time, but no one seems to listen. And Rob just said it, if it's too good to be true, it really, really is. If we're going to offer financial services and it's something we can do, we'll do it under a license. That's why the licensing exists. That's why we spent so many years in financial services to get licensed. We did a whole segment about how to verify someone's FSP license. It's on our YouTube page. If you have missed that, go back, check that out. And again, these impersonations, you really shouldn't be falling for them. Anyone that purports to be someone they're not, you should probably just apply a little bit of logic. If someone like a Johann Rupert, who's worth 11 billion US dollars, not South African rands, who owns Richemont, who owns the Remgro Group, says to you he'll take 50,000 rand from you and turn you into a millionaire, that's not Johann Rupert. It's not that complicated. It's
never been, yeah.
It's not that complicated. And while we're on the topic of things you need to be aware of, the signal providers, right? Rob, you mentioned that there was an FSCA release around impersonations. There was also one around signal providers. And we touched on it when we did the deep dive around the guys that offer you signals and then trade with you and all of that. Signal providers are a regulated service. We've said this before. I've said this on many different platforms. The regulator has now fined a signal provider for providing signals without being on a license. Now, if you don't believe me, again, go visit the FSCA's website. The fine was just north of a million rand with a 10-year debarment. So on the signal side of it, people need to understand that signal provision is a financial service. It is an advisory service. And the regulator sees it that way.
Yeah.
Agreed. I think it was the first one, and there was more to come. Because, you know, what I've also picked up in the, you know, in social media, some of the signal providers aren't believing the situation. You know, that it's one of these phases, you know, the FSC is going through.
Mm.
The other thing that, you know, we are picking up, it's fine. I will provide signals, yeah. I'll just get myself an offshore broker based in XYZ, not in South Africa. I always remind people of a wonderful thing that I learned in Italy. In Italy, it's the person who buys the fake product that gets fined, not the seller.
Oh,
so that's very clever. So the same thing here. If you are based in South Africa and you provide financial advice, it doesn't matter which broker you use. You are still in South Africa and you will be held liable because you can imagine they are scurrying around to come up with solutions. The only solution is to, there are three basically. It's either to acquire an FSP, an existing FSP, to apply for a new FSP, or thirdly, to try and become a juristic rep. The big challenge with all of these things, they are cost involved because suddenly now you have to register a company.
Yes, for a juristic rep. Yeah, you are. There is a fourth option, though, where you can be on someone else's license. Yes. But that we spoke about off-air before we went on to say, you then need to meet the fit and proper requirements. Yes. You then need to write the regulatory exams that suggest that you can be put on a license under an advisory capacity, and you need to be under supervision. So you need to be legitimate.
Yeah.
And when I think about that whole environment, I've been very vocal about it. You have as well, Rob. And I know Sai holds the very same views around how advisory services should be managed and treated. Yeah. And I think from a signal provision point of view as well, I mean, I'm in the process of exploring a couple of solutions around that. But those solutions are going to very much be, and I'm saying this into the camera, in line with regulation.
Yes.
Because there's no getting away from it. No matter how you want to chop it up, no matter how you want to look at it, we can provide signals. The signals are not the bad thing. You just need to understand that you must get them from someone who understands what they're doing, who's regulated now because the FSCA says so, and who's a professional.
Yeah, yeah. If I go back to our Standard Bank day, so we, and they're still doing it, where they provide trade ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the one challenge with a signal, it's basically buy at this level. With a trade idea, you have to provide some form of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to provide a chart that at the end of the day, if you provide a trade idea that the person who reads the trade idea can make an informed decision. On a signal on its own, if I say this morning, go long top 40, it's based on what?
Mm.
So this is the challenge as well. So if you move to a category one intermediary, you can provide trade ideas, but they must be in substantial form.
And you are still required to be regulated.
You are required, and you need to provide a disclaimer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are a couple of bolt-ons, which, you know, which we have not seen with the signal providers, because it's basically, let's say, go long of gold on mm-hmm. the Telegram. There's no disclaimer. And why you went long, there's no, you know, you're not providing the reason. So how can I make an informed decision if I agree with you?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at, again, you know, trade ideas and signals, you know, if you slice it, it's the same thing. But we are moving now to trade ideas that require someone to be under the rep license,
mm-hmm.
Someone to be, well, for fit and proper, they need to be fit and proper. There are a lot of requirements for fit and proper. And then if they send out a trade idea, there needs to be, the client needs to have the opportunity to look at the trade idea and decide if it is good for them. So that's a massive shift.
Mm. The other small thing here that we seem to forget is a lot of the signal provision comes with things like stop losses and take profits.
Yeah.
And that is risk management.
Yes.
Because if I tell you where to place your stop loss, that is risk management.
Yes.
I'm managing the risk on your behalf via that signal, which is a regulated service.
Yes.
Now, trade ideas in themselves and signals, again, those are not the problem. The problem is getting them from an unregulated source.
Yes.
Because you now have to get them from a regulated source, it means you as the client also have recourse. If something happens, for example, you can take it up with the owner of the FSP, you can take it up with the service provider. Right now, if something happens and you get a bad signal from someone who's unregulated, you've got no recourse. You've got no way to kind of state whatever case or put your side of it forward or whatever. At the end of the day, if you're taking advice from somebody else, make sure you understand that that person giving you the advice can do so. It's that simple. It's not complicated, and it's not going to get complicated. It's that simple.
Yeah, it is that simple.
It's very, very simple. You know, get yourself a FSP Cat 1. Look, if you want to move into the MAM and the PAM accounts, then you need a category two because you...
Portfolio management.
That is portfolio management. Mm-hmm. That's even more onerous.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of them... But again, I need to remind, you know, you're not going to get away by providing signals and then using an unregulated offshore broker.
Mm-hmm.
That's still, you are South African under South African regulation, under the FASE Act.
You can try. So you can try if you really must. I will be the one to tell you, you can go try and get things done with an offshore broker. But at the point at which the South African Reserve Bank, the central bank of our country, freezes those funds for breach of exchange control regulations because you moved money outside of the country, you will never see that money again. Please don't come to us to help you, because at that point, it will be too late.
It will be too late.
Yes, very much so.
So yes, you can try and get around the system, or you can just accept the system is there to protect you and operate within the system. Rob, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We've been able to get just the tip of the iceberg around the knowledge that sits within your head. We're definitely going to have more of these sessions with you. Thank you for your time. And once again, anyone that didn't see this earlier, Badass Trader, go get it. Let's update our wall. We're going to be taking a look at some local and offshore picks, seeing if we like them, seeing if we don't, and seeing where they fit on our wall. Local picks this week, Prosus and APSA.
So Prosus, we got a letter from the CEO, the new CEO.
The 100-day letter.
Yeah, which basically
said, love letter, eh?
We should be implementing AI everywhere. Hope you didn't pay anyone for that. I like, look, so Tencent's looking quite positive. It's broken the 400 Hong Kong dollars in Hong Kong. China, yeah, some structural issues there. I was chatting with Stanley economists last week and they're like, yeah, maybe. But there's still a massive discount there. Tencent is a giant of a company. Mm-hmm. The clamping down on the tech stocks around common prosperity and education providers has moved on. Xi Jinping has kind of said, cool, we did what we needed to do. There was a letter published at the beginning of the year that looked really bad, and it was very quietly taken off the Chinese government website, and the relevant official is no longer relevant. So that seems quite cool. And new CEO, is he going to be infinitely better? He's new, and he's going to have new ideas and shakeups and stuff like that.
Mm.
It's a process. I mean, it's jumped a bit on that. Actually, it wasn't the lovely letter, it was the China news. But
yeah, it was the China news last month. I'm looking at it now. We're still kind of in 2022 territory, so way off from the highs of 2023 since that big drop. But I suppose that drop was also just how they did the – I think that was a split, wasn't that?
Or stuff that – yeah, they kept on doing the rejigs. Mm. So that
The readjustments and the cancel out of the shares and the thing. Yes.
The uncomplicated complications.
That one.
Yes.
So are we liking Prosus? I, for one, happen to have some reservations around the Naspers Prosus stable. And my reservations stem from your concentration risk.
Yeah.
Because of the concentration
you're
risk. Yeah. That's what I mean, right?
All the other stuff is lovely. But it's never going to, as someone once said to me, add up to more than a pile of beans.
Mm.
You know,
especially with the fact that they're not willing to unbundle the Tencent holding. So how do you realistically unlock that discount?
You unbundle, and absent of that, you don't. So what you're essentially buying is Tencent, but you're getting it at a nice chunky discount.
Getting Tencent at a discount, and you get a bunch of other little things in between alongside it that don't necessarily leave you overly exposed to Tencent, but still mostly exposed to Tencent.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Where does it go on our wall? Do we like it? Is it easy money for us? Because Tencent does pay that dividend, hey?
Yeah.
They do like a good divvy.
They like a good divvy. And they're also selling down their Tencent stake, but they are still just Tencent.
Okay, so we'll probably find a spot on the wall for it, see where it ends up. APSA.
And I like the banks. They've done surprisingly well. They've done better than I thought they would this year. Their debts aren't so bad.
For me, APSA and Nedbank have been quite the letdown.
Yes, but I was going to say, so I mean, look, there's Capitec.
Yeah.
All in their own up in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
Standard Bank and First Rand.
Yeah.
And then APSA and Nedbank.
Yeah, and for me, like APSA at 170 now, having kind of struggled to even get to 180, having bounced off of 140, I'm seeing a lot of consolidation for the last 2 years between 140 and 200 rand a share. And I don't really know if I want to be – I think there's an alternative.
I think there's alternatives.
And the alternative isn't Capitec, because Capitec north of 3,000 rand is – if you weren't in 10 years ago at 100 rand, you've missed the boat.
There are
for now.
Yeah, there are alternatives. APSA's also, they're going to have to get a CEO. So what are they doing right now?
One in 6 years or something.
So like nothing's happening right now as they kind of chill along.
There's an alternative.
There's a lot of folks who like, it's the one who's always been the lagger. One day it'll stop, except it's just always been. And there's been reasons, sure, but it's always been the lagger.
Yeah. Okay, cool. We're not too excited about that one. Pfizer and McDonald's are our offshore picks.
McDonald's.
Both are giving us earnings numbers this coming week. How are we feeling about them?
I like McDonald's because they're poisoning everyone with E. coli, so the price collapses and then they fix up their E. coli. Well, at some point, Chipotle did it as well. At some point, they stopped poisoning their customers with E. coli, and then we are back to the races. So the stock's not expensive, although the PE's, it is actually quite a chunky PE, actually. Yo, It's a forward P of 24. 10.4 dividend yield. It's just, it's kind of like your Coca-Cola of fast food. And I know that there are many others, and, you know, we can debate qualities and health and everything else, but it is kind of that iconic brand with Coca-Cola. My one big issue with it is the GLP-1 drugs, which is cutting back on obesity and everything else. And I think, and they come, of course, Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. And the question is, what happens in a world where obesity is declining rather than increasing?
Well, then maybe McDonald's should ask Pfizer, because that's our other pick, right?
And that's just it. And it's not just McDonald's, right? Because the way these GLP-1s work is they suppress appetite. Mm. But, you know, Match Group, suddenly we're all more suave looking. So we're all on Bumble or Tinder or whatever the case may be. There's a lot out there with these GLP-1 drugs that can really shake up over decades, can really shake up industries. I intuitively like, and you know what, McDonald's is a really like a chart. It just kind of goes bottom left, top right, man. 10 years, there it is. I zoom it out further, just bottom left, top right.
And then I think for me, what bodes well in McDonald's' favor is the number of stores, right?
Yep.
McDonald's' global footprint. It's not often that you get a company that can sit back and say, they are universal. This is the definition of universal. The yellow M is everybody knows what they're getting.
And you know where
whether it's healthy or not is not the question here. Everybody knows when you walk into something that has a yellow M on it, the mascot is Ronald McDonald. You know what I mean?
I'm trying to find out. They don't tell me how many stores they've got.
Yeah.
But Perplexity will help me with that. It is going to be a lot. 40,275.
That is a lot of stores.
14,000 in America.
Yes.
Then Japan, China, Europe.
Probably should start with shutting down some stores in America.
Yeah.
14,000?
118 countries, 69 million customers a day. That's how many they serve.
14,000 in one country?
It does seem like a heck of a lot.
Seems a bit excessive.
400 in South Africa, which is.
Yeah, and if you walk around, if you travel around South Africa, you see McDonald's everywhere.
And what, America's six times our population, and yet they seem to have a lot more stores.
Okay, so six times our population, we put it six times the stores is under 3,000. Yeah, so 2,500 to 3,000.
14,000.
Right, 14,000. Where are these
but
stores?
But Americans like their McDonald's.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Or they've got no alternative.
But, I mean, think about South Africa. So we're in Rosebank. And so there's one here in Main Rosebank. Mm-hmm. And then you carry on down Glenhove, and a little while later you get to Jansmuts, and there's another one. And it was weird, and I did it once. And if you carry on that same road and you cross the N3 and you get to Edenville, there's another one.
Yes.
And if you carried on, you'd get another one.
That's kind of how – look, the McDonald's thing might be worth revisiting as a deep dive on their real estate model, because 40,000 stores, McDonald's has this very clear thing that they want to own the real estate that their sites are on. So that might be worth a deep dive. But for now, is it going on our wall?
Sure.
Okay, cool. We like it. Yeah. Do we like Pfizer as much?
I don't know much about Pfizer, except that they made a drug we all took.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're all, yeah.
You took Pfizer or the others, whichever's. I, you know what I like about the drug manufacturers is that, yes, I get the R&D expenses. Yes, I get occasionally they do something wrong and poison people. And that's tragic and horrid and everything like that. But if you look at their dividend payers, and my preferred is Johnson & Johnson, because that dividend is just like, it just goes up. Every year it goes up by an amount, and then it pays that for the four quarters, and then it steps again, and it's just a really, really beautiful. So the thing with Johnson & Johnson, and I know it because I hold it and I've dug into it, is that you get about an 8% return on average CAGR from the share, and you get another 3.5% from the dividend, 11.5% in dollars. Never going to shoot the lights out, but 11.5% in dollars, nice.
I wonder how those business prospects will change in light of recent social events that we will not mention. We're going to leave the conversation there. We're going to update our wall. Thanks to everyone for being part of our community, for contributing towards our community. We do have some very interesting announcements that will be coming out soon. So keep an eye out on our socials to see what we're going to be doing. We're going to be changing up things a little bit. Till next time, investing isn't hard. Just try. Try it.